First, I'd like for you to note that I have a slight title change from the program with my presentation. The difference is mainly in title and thought process. Since you know abstracts are due in February, in between the time of February and now, you have time to think about what you actually did to make sure it actually states what you think it did. So my co-authors and I, Dr. Lonnie Snowden, who's retired at UC Berkeley at the School of Public Health, and Sarah Kimberlin, who's almost going to finish her PhD, were my co-authors. The new title is African Americans, Caribbean Blacks, Individuals Perceived Neighborhood Disadvantage and Depression. And before I begin the talk, I would like to disclose that I have no relationships to disclose. Okay, so the objective of our work was that in residing in disadvantaged neighborhoods, it has been associated with a myriad of personal problems, including violence and crime, physical illness, and mental illness. African Americans are overrepresented in disadvantaged neighborhoods, and Black Americans' greater exposure to distressed neighborhoods really show adverse conditions and is thought to mark as a pathway linking African American status or mental health status to various social, psychological, and health-related difficulties. So understanding whether neighborhood disadvantage affects depression is especially important for understanding the mental health of Black Americans. If perceived neighborhood social and physical environmental adversity truly elevates depression risk, then disproportionately many African Americans are exposed to neighborhood-related risk that we need to track. Before going on, I wanted to give you a visual representation of what we were imagining when we designed the study. Excuse me. In the upper left-hand corner, it's a picture of an upper-income household in a neighborhood that looks fairly green and nice and lovely spring pictures. And then in the lower right-hand corner is a depiction of a lower-income neighborhood with boards and boarded-up windows, boarded-up doors, and apparently buildings like this appear very frequently in neighborhoods where people live. When associating neighborhood characteristics and depression, investigators have focused on disentangling the aggregate effects of personal disadvantage from the effects of neighborhood resource limitations, community disorganization, and other features which are not personal characteristics but are genuinely attributes of the social and physical environment. So depression, while it is among the world's leading sources of disease burden, has been linked to neighborhood disadvantage in a body of work and reviewed several times, it is still questionable in research as to its placement and its role in understanding neighborhoods and its connection to understanding mental health of its inhabitants or the residents. In a 2008 review, Mayer, Dietz, Rue, and Galela reported that 27 of the 45 studies studying this relationship significantly related one or more neighborhood characteristic to clinical depression or depressive symptoms. Measures of neighborhood composition and characteristics of the built environment yielded less consistently positive findings than did indicators of social processes such as social disorder. What I wanted to show you here are other pictures of neighborhoods around the country that we believe might influence mental health outcomes among African Americans. And what you see here are pictures of neighborhoods that are in Oakland, Detroit, and Baltimore that each have significantly high representations of the African American and Caribbean Black populations. And the neighborhoods vary. If you are a local Californian and have been across the bay to Oakland, the picture on the far right with the gondola, that is of Lake Merritt. In using geographic coding, or GIS, as most people do, they use census tract, block, or block group levels as indicators. And these variables, including percent of adults with low income or living in poverty households, living in substandard housing, unemployed or percent mother-only families form a cluster of characteristics indicating neighborhood disadvantage. But when analyzing these data, investigators regress depression on neighborhood these neighborhood indicators, and to control for individual-level influences include individual-level indicators of disadvantage, such as income, education, and employment status. While I don't argue that census-based measurement is poor, it is objective, and studies using it do establish a solid foundation for important knowledge. However, census-based measurement does not directly assess underlying sources of social disorder, such as drug sales in the neighborhood. Nor do census-based measures always permit clear definition of two dimensions of neighborhood disadvantage, as we studied. Social disorder is one dimension of neighborhood disadvantage, and it refers to the breakdown of social structures and social processes that maintain public order, civility, and safety. Signs of social disorder include unsupervised and delinquent youth, public intoxication, drug use and sales, and poorly maintained and vacant buildings. Unchecked illegal activity and poorly maintained property signal societal disregard and abandonment and promote a sense of alienation from mainstream society. Such conditions promote antisocial norms and signals a license for otherwise unacceptable conditions to promote antisocial norms and conduct, and often leads residents to perceive their environment as socially disordered. Neighborhood economic and social deprivation refer to disadvantaged neighborhoods that provide few opportunities for employment, offering low-quality schools, low-quality housing, and few recreational opportunities. Neighborhood deprivation also refers to a resident's lack of mainstream services such as taxi service, food delivery, rejection of their credit card applications for personal use and home loans, and similar community business operations. So in sum, rated neighborhood conditions are residents' perceptions, and like other perceptions, they are sensitive to personal biases and distortions. Measuring perceived neighborhood characteristics provides a valuable complement to census tract and other objective indicators of neighborhood conditions. So what we did is that we believe from everyday personal experience, residents are equipped to directly assess their immediate living conditions. Taking into account individual perceptions have been shown to be related to objective disorder indicators and reflect immediate first person's reality on which to act. So the National Survey of American Life, or from here on in, it will be the NSAL, was part of the National Institutes of Mental Health Collaborative Psychiatric Epidemiology Survey initiative that included three nationally representative surveys, the NSAL, the National Comorbidity Survey Replication, which is often called the NCSR, and the National Latino and Asian American Study, or NLAS. The data for the NSAL were collected through face-to-face interviews in English using a computer-assisted personal interview and lasted an average of 2 hours and 20 minutes. The NSAL included a household probability sample of 3,570 African Americans, 1,621 Caribbean Blacks, and 891 non-Hispanic whites and 18 years of older of age for everyone. If you would like more specifics about the data set, I'll be more than happy to share that with you. My postdoc was at the University of Michigan, and I trained the interviewers to collect the data for this survey, so I know it intimately. In terms of the variables for this study, our dependent variables major depressive disorder. It was measured, we used the measure by the CD, which is the Composite International Diagnostic Interview. It was transitioned to use for a survey application. And then for the independent variables, the main independent variables neighborhood disadvantage. So we had it in two aspects. One was perceived neighborhood social disorder and then perceived amenities. Our demographic characteristics were similar to what other studies use, so it's SES, education, ethnicity, marital status, employment status, and immigration status. In terms of statistical analysis, demographics were calculated using one-way ANOVA and chi-squared analysis where it was appropriate. We use multivariate logistic regressions were employed to understand the variable relationships. And as we stated on the slide, African American and Caribbean Black subsamples were also analyzed separately. We will not be reporting them today. But we examined the associations, whether these associations were found to differ between the two groups, and we did not find this difference. So some of the results. I hope you can read the output. With respect to demographic characteristics, African Americans were less wealthy, with an annual household income averaging $36,000 compared to $47,000 annually for Caribbean Black families or households. Correspondingly, more African American respondents than Caribbean Black respondents were categorized as low SES status, with incomes at or below the federal poverty line. And then for African Americans, were categorized as high SES, were below the AFRT number for Caribbean Blacks, for greater than 300% of the federal poverty line. African American respondents were slightly older at 42 years compared to 40 years, and African Americans were slightly less educated, although each of the educational average numbers was 12 years, which is a high school education. And there were more males found among the Caribbean Black respondents than among the African American respondents. This table indicates the association between perceived neighborhood social disorder and past year depression. And it is significant for persons categorized as low SES. For mid-SES individuals, the perceived neighborhood social disorder depression link was also statistically significant, but the association was not significant for high SES individuals. No association was significant between perceived amenities or depression. So depression rates for persons living in non-disordered neighborhoods are closer to rates reported for the general population of African Americans, and depression rates for Caribbean Blacks in the overall sample are similar to rates reported for other NSAL studies, and I have a list of studies that you wish to compare them to. We began by regressing depression on perceived neighborhoods, characteristics, and covariates separately, as I mentioned before, but results that are presented for African Americans indicated that depression and perceived neighborhood social disorder association was significant for low SES and at the boundary of significance for mid-SES individuals. Perceived amenities was not significantly associated with depression for African Americans in any SES strata. So what our results indicate is that Black Americans living at or below poverty line are more likely to experience clinical depression if they live in a neighborhood they perceive to be socially disordered. A similar finding is evident for Black Americans at mid-SES levels with incomes between 100% and 300% of the federal poverty line. So even after adjusting for individual demographic characteristics, these associations remain significant. And no such association was found for high SES persons. Although many were only marginally wealthier than near poor for the NSAL, their greater personal resources may have been sufficient to shield them from depression when they perceived their neighborhood as being socially disordered. Our findings are consistent with other studies that have been conducted in the study without using the NSAL. For example, Amy Schultz's study, who studied 679 African-American women in Detroit, she found that self-reported social disorder was associated with depression symptoms after controlling for individual household income. Other studies where they studied poor neighborhood amenities that included limited access to activity-promoting physical environments and to better shopping and to recreational activities did not find the risk for depression to be significant, but our findings are contrary to this. We found a statistically significant finding. The limitations that I'd like to report are most salient, and you've all read, if you read other research studies, NSAL is cross-sectional. The Caribbean Black sample was only interviewed in English, so we excluded folks who did not have English as a primary language, and as a consequence, they're not generalizable. And finally, individual perceptions of neighborhood, while they're informative, do not offer uniform or objective measure of living conditions. While we get at our first aim, is to look at individuals and how they perceive their neighborhood, we are not certain that everybody judges their neighborhood similarly. So So it was kind of open to interpretation, and we hope for the best. What this implies for policy. Federal policies governing the structure of construction and rehabilitation of public housing and policies governing placement of tenants. I'm sorry, I'm trying to keep the time to make sure I'm on. Okay, good. Placement of tenants in public housing have encouraged development of mixed-income residential communities. So voucher programs to which housing policy has increasingly turned to promote relocation of low-income households away from frequently disorganized, high-poverty neighborhoods by subsidizing rents for housing units elsewhere. It's found as it's largely being used, but it's criticized. Because what we found is that it only rests on thin reeds of empirical support that moving people out of the communities that they reside in to other communities actually improve their mental health. What we found that when you fail to provide sufficient annual increases in rental housing for existing locations, it only exacerbates these worst-case needs and leaves extremely low-income African-American families or American families stranded in an increasingly constricted housing market where they can't move, they can't use the vouchers for anything else. So rental assistance really is critical and a flexible tool that provides access to decent and affordable housing for low-income families, but we recommend, based on our findings, that they can remain in their neighborhoods with redevelopment. Our findings focus attention on housing community development policy that is often overlooked as a key leverage point in improving health and well-being among Black populations. And Black Americans are far more likely than others to receive federal low-income housing subsidies, comprising over 40% of the assisted households. So the implication for public health practitioners. Well, public housing policies do constitute an ongoing and overlooked intervention aimed at disorder reduction and hope for consequences for improved neighborhoods and resident well-being. For the purposes of depression risk and reduction, the present findings suggest that reducing perceived neighborhood social disorder will be more influential than improving perceived amenities. So amenities and social disorder are intertwined. Poor amenities can invite antisocial conduct by signaling low levels of resident social power and limited social control. Where differences in emphasis between disorder reduction and amenity improvement are possible, this study's results imply that reducing perceived neighborhood social disorder will reduce depression risks more than upgrading perceived amenities. So this concludes my talk, and should you wish to further discuss this issue, you can reach me at the University of Albany. I hold offices both in the School of Public Health as well as the School of Social Welfare, or send me an email message. Thank you very much.